The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's good to be back in the booth. Had some time off yesterday, in case you didn't notice. Joel Hilliker filled in here, I think his first time filling in here at the Edstone studio. As he explained yesterday, he and his wife and their three children are here for a few weeks that would include the Philadelphia Youth Camp. So his two older daughters are immersed into the camp program, along with my two children and quite a few others that come from all over the world. We have a handful from Trinidad and Tobago. We have a couple from down in South Africa. I think a couple from Australia. And, of course, some coming from North America as well. So it truly is an international camp. I mean, it's quite a bit smaller than the camp that we put on in Edmond. But we really do cover a lot of territory, at least looking at the geography of the makeup, or the makeup of the camp in that sense. So appreciate Mr. Hilliker being able to fill in. He said he had a good time doing it, as I talked to him after the fact. And it certainly is nice to have some like him and Richard Palmer filling in when it's especially busy at camp for me, like it was yesterday. I had a couple of lectures, and then last night we concluded the busy day with an etiquette dinner. This is an annual tradition that we have at our youth camps, where we really get to experience fine dining, royal dining, here at this youth camp, when so many of the activities, they're hot and sweaty and in shorts and t-shirts, but to then really dress up and get ready for an evening of royal elegance. It's quite a contrast, and of course it fits right along with the theme at this camp and at so many others, of really helping our young people to just, as I said last week, to better appreciate who they are and what God is preparing them for. Well, on today's program, we're going to just run through some of the headlines here in just a bit, and coming up in the second segment, hopefully we can continue our focus on the youth, not only with the Bible study, but also with just a few more headlines that seem to stand out to us more when we're carrying on with these youth programs, these youth camps. And also, hopefully, we can get to some of the feedback that you've sent along these last 7 days or so, when I first asked for you to tell me about your camp experiences. We've gotten some really good comments from some of you listeners. Well, this first item here comes from the Washington Post about the collusion story that's been going on for, what, 6-7 months now? It says here, while everyone is fixated on President Trump's unbecoming and inexplicable assault on Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the media has been trying to sneak away from the Russian collusion story. This is from the Washington Post a few days ago. It says, that's right, for all the breathless hype, the on-air furrowed brows, and the not-so-veiled hopes that this could be Watergate, Jared Kushner's statement and testimony before Congress have made Democrats and many in the media come to the realization that the collusion they were counting on just isn't there. I forget when Kushner testified. I think it was early last week. In any event, following that testimony, here's the Washington Post. I mean, they've been leading the way in so many ways with this Russian collusion story. And now the media is quietly trying to back away from it. It says, as the date of the Kushner testimony approached, the media thought it was going to advance and refresh the story, but Kushner's clear, precise, and convincing account of what really occurred during the campaign and after the election has left many of President Trump's loudest enemies trying to quietly back out of the room unnoticed. And that's the way that it always goes. I mean, never, never are you going to see them come forward and say, you know what, we got it wrong. We all jumped on that bandwagon, and there's no story there. They never do that. They never apologize. I mean, here it's been going on for months. What a waste of time and energy and space on these newspapers. And the world, meanwhile, is on fire, in case they didn't notice. It says here, cable news airtime and in-print word count dedicated to the non-existent collusion story appear to be dwindling. Democrats and their allies in the media seem less eager to talk about it. It says later on in the piece, at last, the story that never was is not happening. The story that never was is not happening. There's a lot more that they could have been covering, or a lot of other stories that they should have been covering. But now they'll move on and they'll find something else, because they certainly do despise this current administration leading the United States. And so they'll focus in on who knows what in the months ahead. And meanwhile, as I say, the real world is going up in flames. Mr. Hilliker's program yesterday, just focusing in on some of those statements by the president a couple of weeks ago, I guess it was. Does the West even have the will to survive? I mean, that's a question that's worthy of a few roundtable discussions on CNN for sure. Do we have the will to survive? Look at the problems mounting. There was a piece in the National Interest a couple of weeks ago. I just haven't had time to get around to it. I haven't had that many programs of late. But it talks about just the wild spending of any administration. And of course, Republicans, they see themselves as, you know, they're more fiscally responsible. They're striving more to balance the budget, but that hasn't been the case. That's not their track record. They can talk about it, but if you go back to George W. Bush, I mean, he was a wild spender. And President Trump, I mean, he's come along after Obama. You know, if you have a wild spender in George W. Bush, President Obama was a wild spender times 3, 4, or 5. And this piece from the National Interest says, so too it looks to be the case with President Donald Trump and the current GOP-dominated legislative branch. I mean, here they control the government now. And they couldn't even pass a skinny repeal last week, as I said, I think on Friday. But it says the former doesn't want to touch entitlements. The latter doesn't like the big cuts President Trump proposed in discretionary outlays in areas such as the State Department. That's talking about the GOP-dominated Congress and then the Trump administration. They both want to spend. Spend, spend, spend. It says, and most of the Republicans are clamoring to fill the Pentagon's coffers. The only question is how much, how quickly. And so an increase in spending right across the board. I mean, it's the same here in the U.K., I mean, in fact, Richard Palmer had a piece yesterday. This wasn't about the UK government spending, but just about the UK household debt. And there was another story following the one that Richard posted yesterday about how the British household debts are rising to worrying levels. Richard was telling me this morning that his piece from yesterday is already out of date. But going back to this National Interest piece about the U.S. spending, the federal government spending. It says here, an update to the budget and economic outlook, 2017 to 2027, revising estimates released only 3 months before. It says, alas, the news got worse. Well, I missed the first part of that last sentence. It's talking about this report released in June, this update to the budget and economic outlook. But the National Interest goes on to say, on the cover, the CBO announced that over the next decade, outlays are projected to grow more quickly than revenues, thereby increasing the debt. Never stops, does it? It just increases. And you have President Obama, just the reckless spending, multiplying our debt or deficit many times over. And then the next administration comes in, and sure enough, we increase the debt. It says here, yet growth in real GDP will be only modest over the coming decade. That is double bad news. The estimated deficit this year is $693 billion, up $134 billion from the January estimate. So they're having to revise their estimates because the Republicans love spending. They can't stop. It's like an addiction. Look at Obamacare. I mean, the United States has been on it now for 7 years, and they can't roll it back. They can't roll any of it back. Government control healthcare, that's where it's headed. That's the direction we're headed in. Well, further on in this article, it says this will all occur without another recession. I mean, this is the estimates that they're revising them upward. Higher deficits, higher debts, and they're making these revisions based upon the forecast that, well, at least or hopefully we'll not have another recession. And, of course, if that happens, then it just makes matters a lot worse. It says the five big spending blocks are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, net interest, that's interest on the debt, and then military. So of those five, I mean, when they get desperate and they have to make cuts, what do you suppose they cut first? Well, like it was during the days of President Obama, they slash military spending. It says the first two benefit, the first two benefit a growing population of elderly who believe they paid for their benefits and vote in disproportionate numbers. Continuing rapid increases in healthcare outlays ensure that Medicaid costs will continue to rise. The only question will be how fast. The fourth category is likely to explode as the Federal Reserve backs away from its policy of near zero interest rates. As soon as those rates go up, the net interest that we're going to be paying on our debt will skyrocket. And so it says here, this is the national interest, which leaves military outlays bearing a large fiscal target. See, the military outlays, they've got a target on their forehead. I mean, that's what the title of this piece is. America literally can't afford more military adventurism. America just can't afford it. Forget about whether or not it has the will to survive. It simply cannot afford it. There was another piece, I didn't bring it down here with me, just on the desperate need to modernize America's nuclear arsenal, particularly in a world where there's more and more rogue actors. Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. But we can't afford it. We can't afford it. It says here, finally, with U.S. debt starting at 77% of GDP today and laws not changing dramatically, says the CBO, growing budget deficits would boost that debt sharply over the next 30 years. It would reach 150% of GDP in 2047. I mean, that seems like a long way off, but that's just 30 years' time. That's one generation. It says the prospect of such large and growing debt poses substantial risks for the nation and presents policymakers with significant challenges, to put it mildly. Indeed, that's a higher level than what Greece suffered before its dual economic and political collapse, from which it has yet to recover. In other words, the collapse is coming, as we know from so many of the prophecies of Herbert Armstrong. So many of his articles and booklets bring it out that it's going to be an economic crisis that really accelerates these prophecies, particularly the rise of the beast power in Europe, those 10 nations. Richard gave me an article today from Handelsblatt, the German publication, about Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel talking about a hardcore in Europe. They're talking about getting the core group together. I know this is something we've talked about often, but here are the two leaders of France and Germany, It says they're considering the idea of creating a powerhouse group within the EU that will work quickly towards mutual economic goals. I mean, in the European Union, you've got, 27 or 28 members, and then the Eurozone, I believe it's 16. And now they're saying, okay, within the Eurozone, within the 16, we've got to find the hardcore. What will happen? How many people do you think would visit our website if they come down to the hardcore number of 10? As that would fit perfectly in with Daniel 2, Revelation 17. It says, according to information obtained by Handelsblatt, the two leaders have been discussing the possibility of increasing cooperation within the Eurozone with some, that's the 16, with some but not all members of the currency union. The two opted not to reveal concrete proposals for these reforms. So there's some concrete proposals they're putting out there, and they're not ready yet to reveal it. They don't want to offend some of the members that might not be involved in it. But this is what they're talking about. This is what they're planning and preparing for. The article says France is very interested in strengthening the monetary union at all costs. France is really interested in this. It mentions a speech that Macron gave in Berlin's Humboldt University. This was from a few months ago before he was voted into the position he's in today. But quoting back from that speech that he gave in Germany, it quotes him as saying, "The time has come for a decision. If our ambition to act together," he's speaking of France and Germany, "if our ambition to act together is not shared in the whole community, we have to find ways to move faster in a smaller group." That's what they're looking for now. They're looking for ways to move faster as a smaller group, as a tighter core, as a hard core. Well, you put that together with what we've talked about quite often over these past several months with the new U.S. administration, the fact that Europe is rethinking its nuclear posture. You remove the American nuclear umbrella, and what do you have? You have Germany and France stepping to the fore. This other article from a few days ago, Real Clear Defense, it talks about the suggestion of Germany building a bomb. That's something we've talked about on this program. It says that's an alarming turn in these events. I mean, that's understating it significantly. Germany with a nuclear bomb, that's now on the table. And of course, if you put them together with France, they already have a nuclear bomb. Or if they take over what's already on their own soil, those American nukes, they already have a nuclear bomb. Well, with respect to nuclear bombs, we've been hearing a lot in the news of late about North Korea and their recent test of an intercontinental ballistic missile and a number of news outlets talking about this being a game changer. But this one here sounds the alarm on North Korea's alliance with Iran. I mean, what happens is as North Korea advances with its technology for nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, this article, again, from National Interest, it quotes the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, who was warning Congress, I think it was last month or the month before, about North Korea being the most urgent and dangerous threat to peace and security. And then it refers to some of the latest missile launches coming out from North Korea. But this article says here, perhaps even more concerning is the potential for North Korea to compound the threat by transferring this dangerous technology to another rogue regime, namely its longtime ally, Iran. Tehran checks every box. Well, it just talks about the threat that Iran poses together with North Korea and the fact that they're both state sponsors of terror and they have nuclear ambitions and so on. But it says here toward the end, for years, experts have suspected North Korea as being the key supporter behind Iran's missile and nuclear programs. Today, many of the missiles Iran would use to target American forces in the Middle East are copies of North Korean designs. North Korean, listen to this, North Korean engineers are in Iran helping to improve its missiles to carry nuclear warheads, according to a report released last month from Iran's main opposition movement. The same movement that exposed Tehran's secret nuclear facilities at Natanz and Arak in 2002. That's a pretty incredible development. A stunning development. You talk about an alarming turn. You know about how dangerous the threat is coming from North Korea. America's Secretary of Defense has sounded the alarm on that. But what about if you see North Korea drawing ever closer to the King of the South? That's radical Islam headed up by Iran. I mean, you look at some of these headlines, and of course the challenge at a camp like this that we've been having here at Edstone is to, I mean, just focus in on this incredible hope that God has for our young people. 1 John 3, verses 2 and 3, and the fact that if you have this hope, you will purify yourself, as that passage brings out. Focusing in on that hopeful future, while at the same time helping our young people to just understand their world, the world that they're living in. I mean, you can watch world events and be reminded on a daily basis that this is not God's world. This world we live in, everything that it consists of, it is not and it never has been God's world. Not since Adam and Eve rejected the tree of life. Jesus told his disciples, I've chosen you out of the world. I went through this with both the boys' dorms and the girls' dorms yesterday. The fact that, as it says in 2 Corinthians 6, God says we're to come out of this world and to be separate from it. To come out of this world that the Apostle Paul said was evil. It is evil. That's in Galatians 1 and verse 4. And when Jesus talked to his disciples about latter-day events, prophesied events, events to be fulfilled right before his return, I mean, he talked about this age, the age of this world coming to an end. Christ certainly did not come 2,000 years ago to try to, you know, repair the damage or to make the best of a bad situation or to try to reform this world in any way whatsoever. He came to start a new world, and it started in the smallest of ways with just a handful of disciples, but that's the way that God works. Jesus came in the flesh 2,000 years ago to start something entirely different from this world we now live in. He came to start a brand new civilization. He came to start a new world. That's what those original disciples were a part of. That's what the members in God's church are a part of. That's what our young people, right here at this youth camp, that's what they're a part of as well. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program with some of your past experiences at youth camps, whether at the Philadelphia Youth Camp, years ago, or at even years earlier than that, at SEP, the Summer Educational Program, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God during the days of Herbert Armstrong. If you'd like to tell us a bit about your experiences at youth camps in God's church, you can send emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. the developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Herbert Armstrong wrote an article back in 1967 about the college of the future here today. He was referring to Ambassador College and commenting on world events. Just as we touched on them in the previous segment, he says, yes, this world is going to end. I mean, Jesus said so. But humanity won't be totally destroyed, Mr. Armstrong writes. God's intervention will prevent it. The earth won't blow up or evaporate or cease to exist, but the world, that is, this system of society, this world's economic, social, religious, educational, and political structures are definitely going to be destroyed. They will be destroyed by the second coming of Christ. You can read that or about that in Revelation 11 and verse 15 and other verses too. But Mr. Armstrong continues on here saying, but a totally new world will shine forth. Jesus Christ, with all the divine power and glory of the eternal God, will return to earth to set up the world-ruling kingdom of God. The world tomorrow will be God's world. We are now at the end of man's world. But here, even now, is the herald of the peaceful world tomorrow. Already in existence are two of the new world educational institutions. See, as he was saying there, I mean, this is the beginning. These educational programs, these youth programs, as I covered last week with you, I believe it was last Wednesday's program. This is the beginning of God's new world. And as I say, you go through a youth camp and you can't help but notice some of these stories that are in the news about youths, about the problems facing so many of our young people in society today. Look at how many people are dying on the streets of Chicago, so many of them young people. So many of them barely out of their teen years, or even teenagers or preteens getting caught up in the crossfire. Chicago just passed 400 homicides for the year, by the way. 400 so far this year. I mean, it's on course to top 700 homicides or murders, and most of those coming from gunshots. It's the second consecutive year. Chicago's going to be up over 700. What has happened? I mean, Chicago hasn't seen this kind of violence and death and bloodshed in decades. In decades. It was alarming last year, and this year, you're 1 or 2% ahead of last year's pace. That's happening on the streets of Chicago. There's a piece here that was given to me this morning about the problems of our young people feeling entitled. Research has discovered that large amounts of young people are developing an entitlement complex, it says. The psychological trend comes from the belief that you are superior to others and are more deserving of certain things. I mean, they're entitled to have this or that. This form of narcissism, it says, has some significant consequences, such as disappointment and a tendency to lash out. Psychology Today reports that some examples of entitlement range from the disregard of rules, freeloading, causing inconveniences, and like to assume the role of leader when working in groups. Here are these young people going through college, hanging out in all of their safe spaces, protesting a conservative speaker. And this is what those universities turn out. Young people who think they're entitled to every possible handout coming from the government. It says the study looked at 170 cases and determined that entitlement leads to a cycle of disappointment, anger, negativity, and a constant need for that person to tell themselves that they are special. This is young people. Young people today. And the article says here, in order to break from this mentality, experts believe that an individual should learn to, or young people should learn to become more humble, more grateful, and accept their limitations. Well, that would be refreshing if young people would become more humble and more appreciative, more grateful for the many blessings that have been bestowed upon us. I was saying to the young people here last night at our etiquette dinner that this kind of fine dining, I mean, a century or two ago, it was pretty much reserved for royalty. And now, I mean, we have been so prosperous and abundant the last two centuries in Ephraim and Manasseh that even the middle class can plan and prepare for something that truly would have been spectacular centuries ago and reserved for just royalty. That's it. No one else. How much appreciation is there among young people today for what we do have, for what we have been spoiled with? Not a lot. How refreshing it is, though, to work with young people who are humble and who are grateful and who do want to learn about God and His truth. There's another headline here. It was almost humorous just looking at it earlier today from the Telegraph. 1 in 8 young people have never even seen a cow in real life. 1 in 8. They've not, I mean, I thought I was a city boy. These are young people that have truly never gotten out of their city life. They've never gotten out of their apartment. They've never gotten out of the concrete jungle to even see a cow in real life. It says here, while they may have spotted a cow on television, 12% of the 18 to 24-year-olds are so unfamiliar with the countryside, they have never even seen cattle in person. A fifth said they've never even left the city. A fifth. That's almost 20%. They're growing up in these concrete jungles, and they don't even see the countryside. They don't even see God's creation. It says further here, the research also found a substantial lack of knowledge among young adults when it comes to basic fruit and vegetables. I mean, what happens when the supply lines are cut? And these families, these young people are trapped inside these cities. All this metal, all this concrete. Basic understanding. Fruits and vegetables. Animals. God's creation. I think every single one of our campers here has probably commented on just how beautiful and uplifting the environment is around Edstone. Just this morning, we had one of the boys' dorms out right next to the sheep paddock, and they were having a contest that involved shooting air rifles and building a fire from scratch, and then baking a loaf of bread on that fire, and to see which pairs could do it the fastest. We have a manhood class. We have a womanhood class. We have Bible instruction. We have sports. They spend a lot of time outside. I can hear them right now on the floor above me, dancing. Tomorrow we go on a field trip down to Britain, or rather to London, to see the British Museum, to visit the Churchill War Rooms. Tonight we have a lecture in advance of that trip to prepare us for it, to give us some guidance on what to look for, what's important when we go into the British Museum, what's important when we look at the Churchill War Rooms. It's a wonderful education. I mean, Herbert Armstrong himself talked about how education comes from study and from travel. I think I have the quote here somewhere in my notes. Here it is. Education is from his autobiography. Education comes from study, from books, from lectures, from contacts, from travel, from thinking about what you see and hear and read, and from experience. How sad to think that there's young people that they never even make it out of their apartment, or if they do, it's just to go to a small school down the street, and that's it. Not that they can't learn in that environment, but God has so much more. He has so much more planned for our young people. He wants to educate them. He wants them to learn how to lead the world. You look at the life of Herbert Armstrong. I mean, God prepared him. God prepared him to raise up those colleges that I just read about from that Plain Truth magazine or that Plain Truth article from 1967. God used him to establish all of these youth programs that continue to this day in this church. Let me play for you a clip from his one of the messages he gave back in 1984. This is clip two, Sam, where he talks about education and what it consists of.
An education consists of study, it consists of thinking, it consists of mixing minds with other people, it consists of travel, it consists of observation and thinking and action. And so I decided that I had the ambition and the desire to work, and I would get my education in that way.
He's talking about that turning point in his life when, at the age of 16, he got a job at a hotel, and he happened to have a manager there in his 30s or 40s, I think it was, who really encouraged Mr. Armstrong to step up. He believed in him. He thought he had what it took to really make something of his life. And this became a turning point for Mr. Armstrong. Listen to how he described that. This is clip one.
But at age 16, I had the first job of my life away from home. And the man I was working for would put his arm on my shoulder and tell me how well I was working and what my performance, it was very good, and that he could see in me abilities, and that he knew I would go places in the world. And he kept telling me this kind of thing and encouraging me, and somehow he aroused ambition in me. And I came to realize that ambition was just two things. Of course, it's a desire to succeed and to have, but also it is the resolution to work and to produce that desired result. And it doesn't come easy, and I knew that.
And so he had the ambition there early on in his life to go out and to receive that education, the way that it's described in his autobiography, a balanced lifestyle. And Ambassador College sprung from that mindset. He wrote in 1949, this was early on in the history of AC, he said, Ambassador College isn't paradise. It isn't the Garden of Eden. We can only vaguely imagine how beautiful must have been the garden into which God placed Adam, and the beauty that shall once again appear on earth after Christ has conquered the last enemy and sin has disappeared. But we feel, compared with today's sordid, sin-cursed world, God has placed us in a spot of beauty, which gives at least a slight foretaste of his glorious kingdom and of the beauty God has in store for those that love him and serve him. Won't it be wonderful when children from all over the earth will be able to enjoy fine dining like our young people did last night, and to receive instruction about table manners, about the art of conversation and fellowship, and then to be in an atmosphere, an environment like Edstone or like Edmond, these two college campuses, where it may not be like the Garden of Eden. It's not yet a Garden of Eden paradise. But when you look at this sordid, sin-cursed world, what a foretaste. What a foretaste our young people can receive at camp, in the academy, at Armstrong College. In Hebrews 10, the Apostle Paul wrote about a new and living way. I mean, that's what we're here to establish. A new and living way. That's what we're here promoting. God's way of life. God's lifestyle. Paul also said in 1 Corinthians 12 about this way, that it's more excellent than any other way. It's a more excellent way, God's way of life, the way of love, the rich and abundant life. I gave a lecture on that over the weekend. That's what God wants for us. That's what Jesus Christ came to give us. You can read that in John 10 and verse 10. Well, Mr. Armstrong, he really did hammer away at this in lectures and messages and in booklets. He wrote in the Seven Laws of Success how important it was for young people to have ambition, to have a goal, to have an objective, to know where they're going, to have purpose. Education, keep in mind, education, it comes from study and books and lectures and contacts and travel and meditation and experiences. I mean, you've got to be out there. You've got to be a go-getter. You can't just sit around and wait for it to fall on your lap. You can't just sit around with an entitlement mentality that, well, I deserve it. I deserve it. My government, my family, my parents, they better give it to me. Mr. Armstrong was just the opposite in his thinking. He really was a young man of ambition, and he went out and he bettered himself. He improved his standing. He educated himself. He grew and overcame. Going back to one of his messages, this is a little bit earlier, 1983, and here's what he had to say about that first law of success, clip 4.
Most young men never think about having a goal. They never think about what are they going to do when they grow up. They never think about what kind of work are they going to do? What kind of occupation or what kind of profession will they get into? Or if they do, they just think, oh, I'd like to be a dentist, I'd like to be a doctor, I'd like to be a lawyer, and they decide to go to a school. And maybe the one who decides to be a lawyer would be better talented and equipped and have more ability to become a doctor. Well, when I was 18 years of age, I put myself through a self-examination by a book I found in the public library that examined whatever abilities or talents, if any, and what weaknesses and shortcomings and faults I had. And also, it went through a complete examination of the professions, the occupations, the different jobs to see where those particular talents or abilities fit and where those weaknesses and handicaps did not seem to do so much harm. Now, I didn't choose just the right profession because the one that I should have chosen, I didn't know yet until God called me. I had no way of knowing it at the time. But what I did choose, I think God guided me in because it prepared me for what I, and gave me the experience that I needed when I did start the real profession that God later did call me to.
And of course, you can read more about that story, that history, in his autobiography, a book we just reprinted last year. It tells the whole story of how God prepared him for his calling. And God was involved, even in his education and in his profession before the calling. You can see that clearly in the autobiography. It's a wonderful example to look to. It's a wonderful example to point our young people to get them motivated and ambitious, to help them receive godly ambition, to be truly educated according to God's teachings, God's truth. There's a proverb that says, "Happy is the man that finds wisdom and the man that gets understanding." That's the thing. I mean, it's there, but you have to go get it. You have to find it. You have to seek after it. And you have to be diligent in doing so, just like the Bereans were in Acts 17. I mean, the Word of God is the foundation of all knowledge. That was the motto of Ambassador College. These young people need that foundation. If they get that foundation right, then you can really build on it. That's what they're receiving, at least a good bit of it here at PYC, and certainly it's reinforced and strengthened and enlarged at Armstrong College. And what an impact these programs have had on God's church, whether during the life and ministry of Herbert Armstrong or even today. Here we are. Armstrong College is about to enter its 17th year. I mean, that's incredible for me to think of because I've been there working at the college since day one. And here we're about to begin year 17, and you really are beginning to see the fruits all over the place of these youth programs. Just like I was saying last week, God is getting quite a return on his investment. When we come back, I'll just go through a few emails that have come in over the last 6 or 7 days. Emails coming from you, some of you parents that have either gone to PYC or SEP yourself or have sent your children off to these youth programs. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I'm speaking to you from our television studios in Pasadena, where I speak to the world as a voice crying out in the wilderness of modern religious confusion.
Herbert W. Armstrong was the world's leading televangelist and one of the most prominent religious leaders of the 20th century. Watched, read, and followed by millions worldwide. But his legacy of Bible-based humanitarianism came under attack after he died. The cabal of leaders who took control of the church he founded, after pledging to follow in his footsteps, methodically destroyed all he had built. Those who would stop them were silenced or excommunicated. This shocking story of betrayal and deception is told in Raising the Ruins. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
Now he said, "This gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed or preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Some great feedback over the last week or so. We got one email here from a listener in Canada who writes, "Thank you for your radio program this morning and how important the youth programs are in God's church. It was inspiring to hear Mr. Armstrong's own words and to think how I was a three-year-old child in the Worldwide Church of God in 1979. As you said, it's so important to teach this God family vision to our children. I'm so thankful for the vision my parents and the church gave me as a young person growing up. I think I had a life-changing experience in 1985 just visiting AC, Ambassador College campus in Big Sandy. The grounds were so beautiful with waterfalls and streams and big trees, and the students were so friendly and happy. I was 9 years old then and remember thinking, I'm going to go to Ambassador College someday. I attended the two-week SEP in Quebec when I was 14. It was an all-French camp with counselors from Ambassador who were either from France or Quebec, and all the ministers spoke French. I was taking French in school at the time. So it was great. It was great, a great way to improve my French, and it made me try to learn it better afterwards, having French friends to write and such. It says, I really enjoyed this camp, especially the activities, canoeing, tennis, fencing. And she goes on to say that she also went to Orr, Minnesota for the three-week SEP camp up there, and that she had heard going in that, it's too strict. It's like boot camp. And she went with her older sister, and they just absolutely loved it. And they learned that if you just submit to the rules, you'll have an exciting and rewarding camp. She was impressed, too, by her counselors who worked so hard to serve the gals. It says here, I'm incredibly thankful for what Mr. Armstrong instituted in the church youth activities, how I benefited from those. My parents were not the best teachers in doctrine or even in their own lifestyle or example, but the great blessings I received from growing up in God's church will forever be with me. I know the credit goes to God for my calling now, and yet I am deeply thankful for our spiritual father, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, and how his efforts did lead us to our Heavenly Father. I can truly see how he fulfilled Malachi 4:4-6, and she goes on to express her thanks for the many programs that are there in the church today. Another one here, coming from Missouri, says, my husband and I didn't have the privilege of growing up in the church or attending any PYC or SEP camps, but we had the wonderful opportunity to send our eldest daughter for the first time this year in Edmond. We do, to the best of our ability, try to steer the children to serve and obey God, to keep focused on headquarters, to follow those things we're taught and admonished. And it says here, the unique thing that camp allows is an environment for the teens to exercise independent freedom, to begin thinking and making decisions on their own free will versus acting in a way to merely please their parents. It says, for instance, we often share our strong desires for our kids to attend AC. That's what we expect. But instead of us building this excitement of their future, PYC gives our teens a glimpse of what it's like to be a student at AC. They are their counselors, mentors, shining examples of living an abundant life. It says, my daughter came home with an overflowing enthusiasm to attend AC. And she's ready to send in her application. She's just in eighth grade. It says excitement stemmed from her seeing why she's there. This is just one small example. There's no better environment than PYC for our teens to exercise independence, to learn to live this way of life for God by their choice. We're so grateful for PYC, and what an incredible tool. Many thanks to all those who work hard and sacrifice to make camp possible. Another one here from Oklahoma says, in December 1980, as a 14-year-old, I attended my first SEP in Australia. It was a defining moment in my life. We were the pioneers that year. The whole camp was threatened by terrible storms that swept away tents. It was such a great experience in enduring hardship, and it turned out to be a camp we always remembered fondly. It says, then in 1986, I attended the SEP in Orr, Minnesota as a staffer. I shared that experience with the man who would one day be my husband. That was a defining moment in both of our lives. It was just following the death of Mr. Armstrong. That year, there was a focus on raising standards and doing things the right way. It says, fast forward to 1995, my husband and I had endured almost five torturous years of turmoil through the church split, which resulted in us being in two different churches. 1995 brought us back together in unity in the PCG. We moved to Edmond, Oklahoma. My husband got a job the day after we arrived and promptly asked for 2 weeks off to work PYC in Guthrie, Oklahoma. For him, the summer camps had been the most important time of his life. He grew up in a dysfunctional family. Being involved in summer camp was like coming home for him. So as an adult, he had a deep desire to give back to the work and especially to work with the youth. It says, finally, throughout the past couple of decades, our children have all benefited from the summer camps as both campers and staff members. It really is a wonderful program that immerses children and adults alike in a way of life that makes the spirit soar. Well, that's an excellent email there to end on. If you'd like to tell us about your camp experiences as a youth or the experiences your children are experiencing, send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.